You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 15th, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
April 15, 1726. Writer William Stuckley held a conversation with Sir Isaac Newton in Kensington, during which Newton recalled when formally the notion of gravity came to his mind. Later, in writing the memoirs of Sir Isaac Newton's life, he recorded that Newton said, and I quote, "It was occasioned by the fall of an apple as he sat in a contemplative mood. Why should that apple always descend perpendicularly to the ground, thought he to himself? Why should it not go sideways or upwards, but constantly to the earth's center?"
So someone recalled someone else thinking he once thought something. No. I am skeptical.
That sounds like hearsay.
It is a scientific fact.
You could prove that? That's falsifiable, Ed?
Oh, you're kidding? Anything's falsifiable on the internet. Thank you.
Yeah. I posit that Newton made that up to impress his friends and that no such incident ever occurred.
We have a challenge, it sounds like.
That's right. And I eagerly await Newton's
response. That's not true, Rebecca.
Response.
Apples fall to the ground all the time.
That's, oh, yeah?
Well, yeah. They're on the ground. They had to get there somewhere, somehow.
Prove that every apple ever fell to the ground.
They grew up from the soil.
That's true. Well, we have a lot of news items this week, starting with a sad bit of news. Sir John Maddox has died at the age of 83. And as I'm sure you're all aware, John Maddox was the editor-in-chief of Nature magazine, one of the, if not the most, preeminent scientific journals in the world. And you guys know where Maddox's career intersects skepticism?
Rupert Sheldrake.
That's one. Yep, Rupert Sheldrake. This is kind of funny. I mean, Maddox, you know, struck me as kind of like an ivory tower British scientist I wouldn't say he was naive, but I think that he was a little shocked by the extent of nonsense that was produced by flagrant pseudoscientists. When Rupert Sheldrake published his book, A New Science of Life, in 1981, John Maddox read the book and was shocked by the horrific pseudoscience it contained. That he got that Maddox in his wrote a commentary, a scathing commentary. And again, Rupert Sheldrake is a ESP researcher. He's still very prominent in the ESP field today. At the time, Maddox wrote a review entitled "A Book for Burning" with a question mark, and said that although he does not believe in burning books, if it were legal, this would be the book to burn. So not exactly how I would have put it.
Wow.
Said it's unnecessary to introduce magic into the explanation from physical and biological phenomenon, when in fact there is every likelihood that the continuation of research, as it is now practiced, will indeed fill all the gaps that Sheldrake draws attention to.
So I obviously agree with his scathing criticism of Maddox, but I think he was so taken aback by how horrible that book was that he might have overdone the rhetoric a bit. And then there's another instance where Maddox and the skeptical community cross paths.
Bigfoot?
No, our own James Randi. Maddox led the investigation of Jacques Benveniste, the French homeopath, and asked James Randi to participate in that as well. Maddox agreed to publish a review of homeopathic studies in Nature, and he was somewhat criticized for that decision, although he justified it by saying that this will open up the dialogue about the evidence for homeopathy. I think fully expecting that, you know, if the light of science was shown directly on homeopathy, that, you know, we would expose it for what it is.
He apparently underestimated the power of faith in people to trump that of science and reason.
Well, I think, yes, and I think, again, it was his just naivete, perhaps, about the nature of pseudoscience. You know, he was a scientist but not a skeptic, so he didn't really realize how the game worked. And what he found out was that the scientific community promptly completely ignored the review because they don't care. about something silly like homeopathy, but the homeopathic community did not engage in meaningful discussion or scientific inquiry. They just used it as a propaganda tool to say that John Maddox and Nature magazine think that homeopathy works and is you know, legitimate. So it became an imprimatur of legitimacy to the homeopathic community and was ignored by the scientific community, except for maybe those few skeptics who realize what a bunch of bunk homeopathy is. So it kind of backfired. It didn't have the results. I mean, any of us, if he could have told him, that's what would happen, but he just didn't know that. But then this was all premised on investigating the claims of Jacques Benveniste. It was that investigation for which he employed the services of James Randi, among others. And, of course, what they found was that Jacques Benveniste could not reproduce any of his positive results when blinded controls and proper scientific methods were put into place. And his claims collapsed under that investigation.
But was he deterred? Was Jacques Benveniste sent packing with his tail between his legs and never surfaced again after that?
No. He moved online and decided to sell homeopathy over your computer.
Mm-hmm. Which I'm sure many people
bought. So you can actually download your cures now that also don't work. But the cool thing, the interesting thing about the whole Jean Benveniste thing I found was that it seemed to be that it was actually one of his assistants that was doing most of the kind of sketchy
fakery
work. Yeah, where it looked like she was skewing data to make it look like the homeopathic remedies were working, as opposed to he himself doing it.
That's a big no-no in science.
Yeah. In general.
Yeah. Free red, right. And Randy tells the story, he picked her out right away. He tells the tale that when they were about to crack the seal on the envelope, you know, to break the code and to see what the results of the study was, everyone was anxious and nervous and awaiting those results. But she was as cool as a cucumber, just filing her nails because she knew the results were going to be negative because she was not allowed to fake the data. I didn't get much of a reaction from you guys on that.
Well,
so
I mean, I knew.
Cool.
You heard that story, right?
Well, yeah. I have never heard that before, sir.
You have educated me, sir.
The next news item comes from NASA, which has apparently photographed the quote-unquote hand of God.
What a picture.
Wow.
It's a gorgeous picture, actually.
It's apparently cool. I didn't realize this, but apparently God is a Simpsons character. He's got three fingers and a thumb.
It's kind of a fourth finger.
I kind of see a fourth finger. Yeah.
Really?
The ring finger. There is no ring finger. I don't see.
Maybe
ring
the
finger.
Low res version. I could only see three. He certainly looked like Homer Simpson.
And for the record, God is in the Simpson is drawn as having four digits and a thumb.
That's a very good point.
Yeah.
Really?
Yep.
Yeah.
What an interesting bit of trivia.
Hmm. Yep, there you go.
So this is an image taken by the Chandra Observatory, which is an X-ray telescope. And this is a picture of a nebula, which is being created by a young and therefore very energetic pulsar, given the extremely sexy name PSR B1509-58.
Aren't you at your post?
So to describe the picture, it looks like a four-fingered ghost-like hand in blue.
Yep.
Or five fingers.
From the wrist up.
There's a bit of a forearm to it, too. The bigger picture, you can see there's forearm.
Yeah.
And it looks like a pretty good forearm. And like the hand cocked back with the fingers and thumb extended, as if it's reaching up.
Yeah.
And then there's a red nebula at the fingertips, almost like it's trying to grab it.
All right, guys, do you see a right hand or a left hand?
It's a right hand.
Well, it's neither. It could be whatever you want it to be.
Depending on what direction it's going. So hold up your right hand in front of you and hold it out like your Hamlet holding the skull. That's kind of the shape of the hand I see.
Well, it could be a left hand reaching away from your body.
I think it looks more like a foot.
Did you guys see this title of this article? It said, Cosmic Hand Surprises Astronomers. And you know, and then I read the short article that was the title to, and it was a good short incredulous article, but they just totally like manufactured that title just to suck people in.
Yeah, well, headline writers are different than the people who write the articles, and that's
their headline
job.
The headlines are usually written by editors or someone else besides the author.
Although, interestingly, NASA scientist Patrick Slain told the CNN, "To tell you the truth, when I first saw the image, it wasn't a hand structure that jumped out at me at all. It was other more complex structures."
Excellent.
Yeah, in other words, he was looking at it at, like an astronomer would, at the details of the nebula, etc. And the sort of the big picture of the hand didn't jump out at him. Very cool. And of course, there was one news story that actually incorporated a poll. You know, they're polling the readers: is this the hand of God or a pulsar?
Like there's scientific debate about this.
Yeah, right. Nice poll.
Is this proof of God?
Well, it'd be funny is if you looked at that from a different angle, it probably would not even closely resemble a hand.
You are probably right.
Yeah, you mean like 100 light years away from where we are now or something?
Yeah. Like, you know, that thing is, how big would that thing be about compared to our solar system, Steve? I mean, would it fit inside our solar system?
That thing is 150 light years across, so no. It's 150 light years across.
How big is our solar system?
Oh, it's not even close to that.
It's a quarter, like a quarter of a light year or something crazy like
that. Oh, okay, so this thing is humongous.
Yeah.
Well, you figure the hand of God would be about that big, right?
It's actually ginormous, Jay, to be technical.
Yeah, you're right.
How does he fit in my heart?
Oh, it's that magic.
Oh, okay.
Well, from the very big, we're going to go on to the very small. Bob's going to tell us about flying microbots.
Nice segue there. I was, for some reason, I was drawn to this article with the title, "Researchers Develop First Flying Micro-Robot."
It were a nanobot, Bob, you would have never...
Oh, forget it.
Just weird.
How big
just
of a step is
down.
It from micro to nano? It's about, very close,
about
right?
About three orders of magnitude.
That's not bad.
These title writers
relative.
Really know how to suck me in. This new class of robot was developed at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada. The team is led by Professor Bayrad Kamasi, who is the director of the university's Maglev Micro-Robotics Laboratory. Now, I hope you're not picturing a tiny Robbie the robot flying around moving little things. This guy, this little robot, is basically a tiny permanent magnet with these micro-grippers attached, all together weighing about 1/300th of an ounce. So this is small and really light, really tiny, but it's incredibly precise, though. They can position this thing to within, if my calculations were right, to within about 1/100th of a millimeter in a tiny volume. It works in volumes equivalent to 3 by 3 by 2 centimeters. So within that volume, it's extremely accurate. Now, it works by using two magnetic fields. The robot, which is a permanent magnet, it has its own magnetic field, right? And that sits on top of a magnetic field created by electromagnets. So they're kind of like one is sitting on the other one. And by altering the current through the electromagnet, you distort its field, which then moves the robot precisely in three-dimensional space. Professor Kamasi says that we develop a focal point of a magnetic field in space, which the micro-robot hangs on. By changing the location of the focal point, the micro-robot is consequently moved. I guess by manipulating that magnetic field, the robot's magnetic field just kind of hangs on in this one spot. So that you move the focal point, you move the robot. And the grippers are pretty cool. These little grippers, you know how they open and close these guys? By shining a laser on it. They shoot a laser at the gripper, it heats it up, which causes the gripper to open. Then they turn off the laser, the gripper cools down, and bam, the grippers close. So do you see a theme here with the robot? It's completely isolated, completely separated from everything. It could be used, they're probably going to use this thing in like for micro-assembly of mechanical components and even handling biological samples and potentially even microsurgery, which I thought was a pretty interesting application. I'll end it with a quote from Kamasi regarding this. He says that since there's no wiring and the robot freely floats in air, it can operate in an enclosed chamber while the whole setup is outside. It can work in hazardous environments, toxic chambers, and can be used to conduct biohazardous experiments. Also, since there's no mechanical linkage, it has a dust-free operation suitable for clean room applications. So pretty interesting little tiny robot.
Yeah, I wonder how big they can make it.
I wonder how small can they make it.
Yeah.
How much smaller can they go? It'll be interesting to see what kind of range they can create. And I see no reason why they can't make it bigger and smaller. So we'll see what they can do with it. It looks pretty interesting.
Does it have like a little carbon nanotube parachute in case the power goes out?
No, it doesn't.
Maybe next year's model.
That's a design flaw.
Don't be stupid, Steve.
That's an option for the more luxurious micro flying robot.
Right. Let's go on to the next item. Jay, you're going to tell us about this year's Darwin Awards.
Well, yeah, I was. Well, I'm only going to really talk about one or two, but I was recently talking to Steve about how I wanted to do a quick talk on the show about coffee enemas, because this is like something that goes way back with me. I remember a long time ago.
Getting Bob, a coffee enema?
No. Bob, you probably remember this. Do you remember reading the news and finding out that which sister of Michael Jackson? Was it Janet Jackson? She was getting coffee enemas.
Probably.
And she said that she gets coffee enemas to get rid of the sad cells that are in her rectum.
Yeah,
the
set. Yeah.
Remember that? Oh, my God. No,
Bob,
I remember that.
That is not
so
true.
So ever since then, I don't know, I just think I've hated coffee enemas. I hated the whole idea of using that therapeutically. And it's really ridiculous thing. And I'll talk more about it, I guess, in the next show. But anyway, so I'm doing searches on Google. I'm reading up on the whole thing. And I get to the Darwin Awards page, which I love. And the Darwin Awards is basically a list of ridiculous ways that people have either severely injured themselves or died through, you know, miscalculation or lack of intelligence.
Well, to be clear, though, the severe injury would have to be in such a way to stop them from procreating, hence the Darwin Award.
Right, because the idea is that they've removed themselves from the gene pool.
Right.
And that's what the award is given for. But, you know, if you go to darwinawards.com, you could read all of it. They go pretty far back. I think as far back as like 1995 or even older. And there's just hundreds of stories on here. It's ridiculous, like all the stuff that you could find. So anyway, so what am I getting to? So I found this story. This is it. I'm just going to read this one here. It's awesome. May 2004, 58-year-old guy from Texas. His name is Michael. He died of ingesting too much alcohol. And then as you read on, the idea, though, was that this guy had like a bad throat injury or some type of ailment with his throat, and he couldn't drink alcohol, so he was having alcohol enemas.
Oh, God.
Literally absorbing the booze in his butt.
Mm.
So he goes out one night, buys 1.5 liter bottles of sherry, which is really cheap booze. And that turns out to be over 100 fluid ounces of booze. And I did a quick calculation. That's about 20 glasses of wine.
Wow.
You do a quick thing, like how many glasses of wine can the average person drink? If you're a regular drinker, you could drink about 3 or 4 glasses of wine and you're going to really feel it. Really feel it. I mean, you hit the 5, 6, 7 mark, you're done. You hit the 10 mark, you're really done. This guy is up in the 20 plus range.
Yeah, but is it drinking it is equivalent to the enema? I mean,
well,
the absorption
what I read,
similar?
Bob, the alcohol absorbs more quickly through the capillary beds in your rectum than your stomach. Well, not your. It's not. Alcohol isn't actually absorbed in your stomach. It's absorbed in the short area right past your stomach. But anyway, that's what I read. That's what happens. So you actually could absorb it faster.
When does it hit the liver?
That's why you have to take some medications, right? And you know, from other orifices, because they get into your system more quickly. So. Right?
Does it like bypass
the
liver
doctor,
if you go in the back door like that?
No.
It goes into your blood and your liver still filters the same way, but it just absorbs into your system quicker.
Well, but generally medicines that are given PR, right, per rectum, that route is used because for some reason you can't take it orally, but the absorption is not so much quicker that it's used to increase the speed of drug delivery. Sometimes, although that may be an advantage for some drugs, but usually it's not worth it to do it just because it gets absorbed a little bit quicker. It's usually because you can't, for whatever reason, you're unconscious or whatever, you can't take it orally.
So he couldn't throw up for obvious reasons. So the guy literally passes out from the booze, and at some point over the night he died. In Connecticut, where we live, the legal limit is 0.08 blood alcohol.
Blood alcohol level.
Guess where he was? That's legal. You can get arrested, I think, at 0.08 now. where we live. But what do you think?
You mean
driving? Yeah, yeah.
He right, oh 8%. God,
he was probably
twice 0.25.
He was 0.32.
He was 0.47.
Whoa,
that's high.
Could you imagine?
Yep.
For some quick background, the blood alcohol content in the United States is we use the percent by volume. So this is the mass of alcohol per volume of blood given as a percentage. So 0.47 would be 0.47%. And the LD50, or the lethal dose that would likely kill 50% of humans, is 0.40. Although there are reported cases of people surviving with higher content, 0.55 has been reported and verified. And there is even one case of a 0.914 that was in Bulgaria that was reported and confirmed, apparently.
So then I read the whole thing on there. And then there's I guess you could sign up and you can leave comments after each one that you read. So check these out. So these are reader comments. One of them is drunk off my ass. takes shit face to a whole new level. No, he earned the award. No ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
What a bummer. Wrecked him.
Killed him.
Killed him. Can I just...
Drop never touched his lips. coitus alcoholis. And then the last one was bottoms up. Oh, no, here's a good
bottoms
one.
Bottoms up. That might be my
never
favorite.
Never again will I look at a table full of liquor at a party and think, damn, that's an ass load of booze.
Oh, my God.
Okay, so this is a good site to go to. It's a lot of fun.
It's that morbid kind of fun where you feel terrible every time you chuckle. Because, I mean, it's awful. Like, there must be something really terribly wrong with this man to have made him do that. I mean, who
does
that?
Well, he was an alcoholic. He was an alcoholic. He had to get his booze. Yeah, that was it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like smoking through your tracheostomy, you know? I mean, it's like that kind of desperate...
That I find much funnier.
The kid's dead.
Right.
I think that guy shouldn't win a Darwin Award for it, though, because he was already 58. I mean, how many more kids was he going to
Well, if you want to get technical.
Yeah, I guess Darwin was done with... Or
I think so. He won, really.
You know, guys can have kids into their 60s, 70s.
That's right.
He can, but it's rare enough that...
Anyway, I thought I'd share that with you guys. A little bit of humor.
All right, well... We have some more homeopathy nonsense in the news.
No.
Yes, we do. For the two listeners out there who don't know what homeopathy is, it is the 200-year-old practice of diluting substances to the point where there's no active ingredient left, and then using the basically water that you have left as a remedy. It's utter nonsense. It's been disproved by a couple hundred years of basic science. And in clinical trials in the last 30, 40 years, it's essentially been disproven also. It's shown no consistent effect. No one's been able to come up with a single homeopathic remedy that can consistently be shown to have a real physiological effect or measurable medical effect. It's essentially consistent with noise, with a null effect. Well, the Cochrane Collaboration recently published a review of the use of homeopathic remedies to treat the side effects of cancer therapy, either radiotherapy or chemotherapy. The study was led by Dr. Sozi Kassab, who is a specialist in complementary cancer therapy at the Royal London Homeopathic Hospital. Now, the vast majority of news reports are... Again, probably just parroting the press release saying that homeopathy eases cancer therapy, or again, essentially that homeopathy works. However, this is a terrible review, absolutely terrible. And it represents a trend that I find extremely disturbing, which is, now the Cochrane Collaboration is a group that essentially is an evidence-based medicine organization, right? They're an independent group that promotes evidence-based medicine, that does systematic reviews of the literature to say, like, what does the evidence support? What's the bottom line? And generally, the reviews are excellent and can be relied upon. Although what I see happening recently is that complementary and alternative medicine proponents are being put in charge of doing the Cochrane reviews. Like in this case, it's kind of like putting the fox in charge of the hen house. And they're coming out with these, you know, rather poorly done reviews, or they're overstating the state of the evidence, which is kind of the whole point of doing the review in the first place. So in this case, for example, there were a small number of studies. They really only identified 8 studies. Most of them were of poor quality. There was only a few what they considered to be high-quality studies, and most of those were negative. But there was, you know, 1 or 2 studies that were reasonable where the results came out positive. And then they used that to say that there is an effect, but it needs to be replicated and more research needs to be done. Now, I got to tell you, you know, from the reviews that I've read just on any topic from Cochrane Review, with this level of evidence, in my opinion, your average Cochrane review would say there is insufficient evidence at this time to draw any conclusions about the effectiveness of this treatment. But now, with the same level of evidence, they're saying it works, but we need more studies, which I feel is disingenuous. And I think that's a reflection of the bias of the lead author. That's what you get when you put a homeopath in charge of doing a homeopathy review. But here's the biggest problem with this review. In addition to the fact that the evidence is actually quite lacking, there's very few studies. Most of the studies are crappy. The one big study that was high quality that worked, and this was pointed out by Edzard Ernst, who was excellent, and I'm glad to see that he's getting interviewed a lot by the BBC for these articles, because he puts it into perspective. He said that, I'll just quote him from the BBC article, nobody doubts that undiluted remedies can have effects, and interestingly, the positive studies here seem to be on such medicines rather than on the highly diluted treatments, which are a hallmark of homeopathy. In fact, the calendula cream found to be effective in one study is not diluted at all, and thus it cannot, to all intents and purposes, be considered to be a typical homeopathic remedy. So there you go. This is incredibly deceptive to do a study on a quote-unquote homeopathic remedy, but using an undiluted substance, meaning active ingredient. That's not homeopathy.
Right. Wow.
It's not homeopathy. It's a deception, but it's used to say that homeopathy works. No, some drug worked in an undiluted form. In fact, the calendula cream is known to have the effect that they were looking for, right? It's known to reduce, you know, these symptoms, these skin symptoms.
Isn't this the same thing like Zicam, you know, which is claimed to be a homeopathic remedy, but it has zinc in it?
Yeah, it's cheating. Yeah, it's cheating.
So, Steve, do you think they're moving in this direction now?
Well, I think that they're doing, again, this is just a desperate grab for legitimacy. They're doing this to muddy the waters and in order to be able to, you know, then put out a press release saying homeopathy works. But, you know, homeopathy defined how, right? And it's also part of the big problem with a lot of complementary and alternative medicine modalities is that their concepts are not well defined. They don't have any coherent kind of, you know, scientific theory behind what they're doing. So what is homeopathic? What does it really mean? If you could use an undiluted drug and call it homeopathy, then what does that say about the principles of homeopathy? I liken this to doing quote-unquote acupuncture, but then using electrical current through the needles. No, that's not acupuncture. That is electrical stimulation, right, which we know has a physiological effect. But that's cheating to call it acupuncture. Giving a drug and call it homeopathy is cheating. It's meant to be deceptive. And I think the ultimate goal of that is to, again, be able to have headlines that say homeopathy works. And then you give the stuff that's diluted to such a point that there's not a single molecule of active ingredient left. And you say, well, that works because this undiluted thing was shown to work. And it's really, again, the worst thing about this is that the Cochrane collaboration is being taken for a ride, because they are putting, again, they're putting in charge of these kind of studies people who are ideological advocates. That's a serious problem. And I see that as a trend within CAM in general, at universities, in journals, and regulatory agencies. They are the people who are, you know, alternative medicine practitioners are the ones that are being put on the committees, are the gatekeepers, are making the decisions. So of course they're going to be endorsing their ideology, and they're not going to be, it's not really giving the independent scientific review of these modalities that it deserves. That is a terrible trend that is not doing the public they service. But it's happening mainly because, you know, the scientists and deans and regulators, whatever, they don't want to bother with it. So they're happy to have somebody who this is the guy who's in charge of alternative medicine, so he gets to make all the decisions. I'll just turf it over to them. But, of course, they're a proponent. It's a big problem. And it's also, my last word on this, this is my problem with evidence-based medicine. And this is why I started the science-based medicine website, where I have quite a few colleagues blogging over there with me. The problem with evidence-based medicine, which is what's promoted by the Cochrane Collaboration, is that it doesn't take into consideration the extreme scientific implausibility of treatments such as homeopathy. It looks at the evidence on a level playing field as if we're starting from square one, right? With each new claim, it's as if we know nothing about it, rather than using what we would call more of a Bayesian analysis, where you start by how probable is this given everything we know about science? And then you add evidence to that to say, now after this evidence, where are we? So if you start with extreme scientific implausibility, which you definitely have with homeopathy,
you got to raise the bar.
Absolutely. It's going to take more than 8 crappy studies to say that it works. Then this is a perfect example of where evidence-based medicine fails and why we need science-based medicine. Put the science back in medicine.
Damn straight.
Right. And we're going to end the news segment with a bit of a lighter element. Evan, you're going to tell us about ghosts in the UK.
Well, yep. And there's a new, well, not a study, but a survey that has been published. And some interesting facts came out. Amongst them, as the headline reads, 4 out of 10 people in Britain believe in ghosts, and more than half of them believe in life after death. And this research was done by Theos, a theology think tank. So take that for what it is.
So does that mean that 10% of people believe in life after death but not in ghosts?
I don't think that's quite right.
Something like that. Somebody's got to believe in one, not the other.
By comparison, they said in 1950, the same question of asked of Britons, do you believe in ghosts, 10%.
Wow, 10 to 40.
10 to 40.
I wonder why.
The speculation is that as traditional religious beliefs are waning, these other more new age supernatural beliefs are filling the gap. That's the speculation.
And that's, you know, not necessarily true. I found in a recent survey of U.S. citizens back in 2007, 48% of U.S. citizens believe in ESP. Mm-hmm. But in 1996, it was 66% of people surveyed believed in ESP. So I don't know. I think it probably jumps all over the place for a lot of different reasons. I think, you know, they're trying to strand all this with a theological thread, mm-hmm, and try to, you know, determine some things based on that. But I don't know. There's kind of this chaos factor, I think,
right,
that goes into this. And,
but at the same time, you know, I think that article also said that there is a slight increase in skepticism over the same period of time.
Yeah.
That's
Paul
nice.
Woolley, who was the director of Theos, he said the following things. He said, the Enlightenment optimism in the ability of science and reason to explain everything ended decades ago. Well, you know, that's not exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
Science and reason.
Wow.
To explain everything. And then he says, the extent of belief will probably surprise people, but the finding is consistent with other research we have undertaken. He continues, the results indicate that people have a very diverse and unorthodox set of beliefs. I think that's right. Our research may point to a slight increase in skepticism about aspects of the supernatural.
Woo-hoo!
Over the last 10 years.
That's a slight increase in skepticism.
Yeah.
We'll take whatever we can get.
Yeah, so at this rate, how long will it take for the whole world to be skeptical?
Yeah, only about 200 years.
But you're thinking of it, you know, you're thinking of it in very linear terms. It's more, to me, it's more like S curves. You know, it's up, it's down, it's way, it's, you know.
Or
back and
maybe
forth.
It's geometrical. Maybe the amount of skepticism will double every year, in which case it won't take us long at all.
Like Moore's Law of technology?
Right. Right. Moore's Law of skepticism.
Wouldn't that be nice? Oh, and for the record, here's some other, I'll just throw out these statistics when I looked up what U.S. citizens believe. 34% believe in ghosts. 23 of them have seen a ghost. 31% of liberals believe in ghosts, and 18% of those who are politically conservative.
Now, see, I think with that breakdown, that's religion, in my
see?
Opinion.
Yeah, you're right, Steve. I think you're right. What was another one? Oh, yeah. 30% of people have awoken to a strange person in the room. What a strange person.
Yeah, that is.
Well, that, you know, that
hypnagogia
happens quite often, depending on how much you drink, right?
But, you know, get to take the bottle out of your butt and we find out. Yeah. Oh, and this. Oh, here's one more interesting statistic. We'll wrap it up with this. 51% of college graduates believe in ESP. 37% of high school graduates or less believe in ESP.
Oh, wow. College is doing
Isn't
a good job.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, that's old news, though. I mean, a college, that education actually increases belief in the supernatural. You would think that there would be a correlation the other way, but it probably has something to do with just being open about strange or unusual or fantastical ideas. It doesn't really get to the point where you have a higher, almost postgraduate level education in science. That education then starts to decrease belief in the supernatural or the paranormal.
You start whittling it down, though, as a percentage of the population when you start getting to that level. I mean,
right.
You whittle it way down. So there you go. 40% of Britons, they believe in ghosts.
Rebecca, does Sid believe in ghosts?
I don't know. Do you want me to ask him?
Could you?
Only if he gets on your headset and responds in a very British accent.
Hello, Sid.
Hello.
Hey, Sid.
Hello, Sid. You're on the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Hey, Sid.
Hey, Sid, do you believe in ghosts?
Steve wants to know if you believe in ghosts.
No.
No, not at all?
No.
There you go. Do you need anything else?
It's like a straw poll of one person.
No. All right, so in our very scientific survey, 0% of Britons surveyed believe in ghosts. All right. Thank you, Sid.
Thanks, Sid.
No, thank you.
Steve, we should send those poll results to the Cochrane collaboration and see if they do a report on it.
Right. Well, let's go on to some of your questions and email. But first, a word from James Randi.
Hello, this is James Randi, if you haven't guessed already. I'm very pleased to announce that registration is now officially open for the Amazing Meeting 7, the biggest and best critical thinking conference in the world, to be held from July 9th through the 12th, 2009, at the beautiful South Point Casino, Hotel, and Spa in Las Vegas, Nevada. This is a change in venue that will better accommodate the size of crowd we got last year, just short of 900 skeptics of all sizes, ages, shapes, ethnicity, homelands, and degrees of enthusiasm. This July, our speakers will include the ubiquitous Michael Shermer from the Skeptic Society, our good friend Adam Savage of the Mythbusters, our president Phil Plait from the Bad Astronomy blog, of course, Jennifer Ouellette from the Science and Entertainment Exchange, and the Penn and Teller duo, and of course, moi. Our keynote speaker this year will be Bill Prady, executive producer of the hit television show The Big Bang Theory, and he'll tell us about how he's helped make it cool to be an accredited official nerd. We'll also have our usual stellar panels, workshops, and after-hours entertainment, including a mentalism act by a well-known, bearded, and cranky skeptic you may know and love. He'll be offering his audience a couple of brand new mental wonders that have not been shown before, even to the magicians of the world. Those who attend TAM 7 will also witness an actual real-time test for our world-famous Challenge Prize, an actual scientific, statistically correct, carefully controlled test which may lead to the awarding of the $1 million prize. This is just not to be missed. For more information, go to amazingmeeting.com, that's amazingmeeting.com, to get all the information on this amazing event. As always, this is James Randi, still amazing, and I hope to see you there in Las Vegas at the Amazing Meeting 7.
Well, let's move on to some of your questions and emails. First, a few corrections from the last couple of weeks. I'm going to start by a letter from Mark Wilson, a professor of geology at the College of Worcester, and he writes, "Hello, Rogues. I love the show, having listened to every episode from the beginning. It's not only funny, but I always learn something I can use in either my teaching or research."
Cool.
We're helping
cool.
geology research. That's awesome. "I can now return the favor in a very minor way. I am a paleontologist who specializes in invertebrate fossils and evolution. I teach geology at the College of Worcester. In your discussion of the large deep-sea protist Gromia spherica, you wondered why its shell is called a test. Is this true for shells found in other protist groups, such as foraminiferans, and for the primary skeleton of echinoids, including sea urchins and sand dollars?
Mm.
The term comes from the Latin testa, which means, simply enough, a shell, and was sometimes also used for a skull or even a pot. In biology, the term is often used to designate a shell which has soft organic material on the outside as well, something like the skin over a skull during life. Protists and echinoids usually have some sort of layer covering the outside of their testes. You covered the evolutionary implications of Gromia and its tracks very well. I studied trace fossils and can tell you that this discovery made quite a stir in the scientific community. Again, excellent show. If you ever have paleontological questions, I'd love to give them a try. Well, thanks, Mark. So he's referring to, we discussed the macrobe, the giant protist a couple weeks ago. It has an outer coating of fecal material.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Inside the test.
Right. And that outer coating was called a test. And Bob, I didn't know what the derivation of that word is or why they use that term. So thanks for that.
Steve, didn't we also get another email from somebody dissing our coverage on that very topic?
Yeah, well, this is unrelated to the test thing, the terminology, but somebody thought that...
Our coverage in general of the topic he didn't agree with. I don't know.
I'll go with the paleontologist.
Yes, me too.
Evan...
Argument from authority.
Evan, another... correction from last week. Apparently, you totally screwed up your coverage of the "is corn syrup kosher" question.
That's right. I was right.
Am I no longer Jewish?
Yeah, we relied upon your authority as a Jew, and you let us down.
I think I said I didn't know.
I strongly suspected I was right on that, but I didn't want to push it because who's going to question the Jew? Not me.
Wow.
Yeah. But actually, the funny thing is, Evan, I knew you were blindsided by that question, so I actually looked it up in post-production, which I often do a little fact-checking in post-production, and what you said seemed to check out on the first link that I went to, although this story is apparently a little bit more complex, that there's two main kosher traditions, and within one tradition, it's fine, but within another one, it isn't kosher for Passover.
What is that? Kosher?
And, you know, nobody mentioned this in, like, that. That was brought up a few times in the emails that were sent to us. But I actually did look into it a little bit before the podcast because I'd seen it and I was curious about it. And what I had read was that there were there are some kinds of corn syrup that have been specifically created to be kosher. So there are corn syrups on the market that are kosher, while there are others that are not.
Yeah, because they're supervised by a rabbi in the production process.
Yeah, I think it's a little
supervised,
different than that. But
loosely.
Yeah, so it's. I think both things are correct, that there are you know, different levels of orthodoxy that either accept or reject the use of corn syrup, and then there are also different purveyors of corn syrup that can be kosher. So.
Right. Well, Rabbi Lerner says the general rule was to prohibit corn syrup when it was uncertain whether the preparation of the corn syrup was done with the appropriate supervision. But there's always a couple of layers of complexity that you don't get to unless you really dig into it deeply. So there's layers here.
A couple of kernels of truth, right? Behind the corn syrup.
Right.
Of course, ultimately, I think we're all agnostic about corn syrup.
Yes.
That's why.
That sounds good. One last one. This one comes from, I'm not exactly sure how I'm supposed to pronounce the name. They use kind of funky things, but Andrak Hackbert, if that is your real name. And they write, it was stated on the last podcast, 193, based on a new scientist survey that 48% of science school teachers said that they taught about creationism or ideas a legitimate alternative to Darwinian explanations for the origin of species. That's a lot. I used this in an argument with my wife. She said I would have to back it up. The following is from the New Scientist survey. Then he quotes, however, a quarter of the teachers also reported spending at least some time teaching about creationism or intelligent design. Of these, 48%, about 12.5% of the total survey, said they taught it as a valid scientific alternative to Darwinian explanations for the origin of species. So, Andrak continues, 48% of a quarter of the survey equals about 12.5%. Am I reading this wrong? Nope, I screwed up. You were correct. It was 12.5% of the total survey. I missed a bit about the 48% only being of the 25% who teach about creationism or intelligent design. So those are the accurate figures. Next email comes from Marty Tsai, who writes, I've been debating with a friend about the nature of science, and he brought up the following argument. Number one, all inferences from experience to conclusions about the future presuppose the principle that the future will resemble the past. This is the principle of uniformity of nature. If we suspect that the course of nature may change and that the past is no guide to the future, then all experience becomes useless and does not support any conclusion about the future. Number two, therefore, no argument from experience can support the principle that the future will resemble the past. Number three, no deductive argument can establish the principle that the future will resemble the past. Number four, therefore, the principle of uniformity of nature cannot be rationally justified. Number five, if the principle of the uniformity of nature cannot be rationally justified, then inductive reasoning in science cannot be rationally justified, leading to number six, therefore, inductive reasoning in science cannot be rationally justified. Your thoughts? So what this is, you guys, I don't know if any of you guys recognize this line of argument. Well, this is not new to Marty's friend. I mean, this has been around for a while.
No,
Anthropic principle, right?
No. Is it Hume?
Yeah.
What the hell was?
Yes, yeah. David Hume.
Wow, nice, Bob.
This. Good one.
Thank you.
Yeah, so Hume, obviously a brilliant thinker, brilliant philosopher, you know, posed this, not trying to say that science is bunk, which is sometimes often how it's used today, but just to say, just from a purely logical point of view, there's this dilemma, this induction dilemma with science, that how could we use induction to prove that induction works, right? That the future, that the laws of nature, and that we can learn about the future by thinking about or observing the past or the present. And science becomes circular reasoning. We know it works because it works. But there's, you know, this question has been mulled over for quite a bit of time. The problem here in this line of argument is the phrase, if we suspect that the course of nature may change and that the past is no guide to the future, well, we have a lot of good reasons to think that the past is a reasonable guide to the future. Now, if we just take everyday experience, for example, we behave as if the past is a reliable guide to the future, right? We won't jump off a 10-story building because of why? Because when people have done that in the past, they've fallen to the ground and splatted at the bottom, right?
Well, I think that the past is an amazingly reliable source of information about the future.
Sure. So we all go about our everyday lives assuming that all the things we learned about how the world works, you know, if we sit on a chair, it's solid, it will support us. If we turn our steering wheel of our car to the left, the car will actually turn to the left.
But Steve, that's the crux of the entire argument, it seems to me.
Yeah.
And we just shot it down, so therefore that's it, game over.
The whole thing collapses, I agree.
Collapses, yeah.
So then we look at the bigger picture, though. So, okay, so in everyday mundane things, sure, you know, the past seems to be a reasonable guide to the future. But how do we really know in the more subtle aspects of how nature works it is? And there's a couple of ways to look at this. One is the fact that this principle of uniformity in nature is not an assumption of science. It actually is just one other thing about the universe that can be investigated by science. And we don't assume it. It actually is something that we can address. So, for example, we, you know, measure the speed of light because we can, you know, flash a mirror off of the moon, for example, or with other methods, you know, we can infer or measure the speed of light, and over time it seems to be a constant, right? It's not fluctuating over time. We don't get, you know, significantly different values for the speed of light on one day or the next. So whenever we measure constants or measure, you know, laws of the universe, once they're well established, they seem to hold up over time. The basic laws and constants of the universe seem stable as we investigate them. So to the extent that it's been observed, the principle of uniformity holds true. Although you can also look at it as, well, science is about making predictions about the future, right? It's about coming up with an abstraction of how the universe works, using that abstraction to make predictions about what will be observed in the future. So scientific knowledge stems from those predictions coming true, right? If they didn't come true, we wouldn't have any scientific theory or any scientific knowledge. If there were no uniformity in nature, the only thing you could really say is that we can't know anything, right? Is that the universe is inscrutable and chaotic and unknowable. That would be the only thing that you could really say. That means that the past 300 years of formalized science has been what I call a meta-experiment, right? It's been a meta-experiment about the very question of, does science work? Science working being dependent upon the fact that there is uniformity in nature to the extent that if we make predictions based upon our theories, you know, and the theory is correct, that the predictions will come true, right? If the universe were quirky and chaotic, we couldn't make any predictions because the rules would constantly be changing. And therefore, you get to this very practical argument of, well, has science worked? You know, have we been able to generate theories and abstractions that make predictions that are validated, that come true? And I think the answer to that is pretty clearly yes.
So, duh.
Yeah. I mean, so not only do we, in our everyday lives, the little things that we take for granted, you know, hold up, but like my favorite example is the fact that we've used our abstractions about gravity, the gravitational constant, about force and the formulas like force equals mass times acceleration, the structure of the solar system, to send a little hunk of metal millions of miles away and are rewarded by getting back beautiful pictures of Saturn and its rings, right? And we wouldn't have gotten rewarded by these close-up pictures of Saturn and its rings if science didn't work, if there wasn't uniformity in nature. So that's a pretty good validation, I think, that that the premise of uniformity is reasonable. So that's the answer. And I think that this also is in the context of, again, science is not about ultimate philosophical metaphysical truths, right? It's only about an approximation of nature that works as far as we observe or as far as we can tell and making predictions.
And we adjust, and it gets adjusted accordingly as more evidence presents itself.
Yeah, absolutely. But not, and you can't say anything to a philosophical certitude in science because it's not about it. So any philosophical criticism that ultimately says, well, science cannot prove that something must absolutely has to be true based upon philosophical first principles, the answer to that is that's correct. It's also completely irrelevant because the scientific method never claimed that it does that. It's not about that at all. It is about just making predictions and seeing how well they work out.
And that's good enough for me.
Right.
That's the best we got.
It's the best we got.
S is for science. That's good enough for me.
And now, Randy speaks.
So, Randy, we were talking about earlier the intersection between the human brain, which is my specialty, I'm a neurologist, and magic, because magicians are actually put into practice a lot of practical knowledge of the human brain, about how to deceive the way people process information, so ways of exploiting the foibles of the human brain.
The point that I would make here is that as a magician, as a young magician, just as a kid, I discovered that I had to know a lot about psychology and the way people's brains work. Now, I never got into it as deeply as you have, of course. You've spent your life at it. But I did learn a few things, and some of those things I think I was able to impart to not only the other magicians, but a few scientists along the way. For example, one thing that we learn as soon as we get into the profession is that people assume a lot. Now, we assume a lot, this is my analysis of it, because otherwise we'd become catatonic. We'd just stop dead, you know. You look at traffic lights. Red means stop, and green means go, and yellow means go like hell. Mm-hmm. If you had to wonder, as you reach the edge of the pavement, have they changed the meaning of the lights? Are the colors changed around, or am I not seeing them correctly? You know, I often tell my audiences when they sit down, you folks make a lot of assumptions, and I hope you will for the sake of my act. I didn't see anyone test the chair. Mm-hmm. When they came in here, did you test the chair to make sure it was sufficient to support your weight? No. You took it for granted. You have to make assumptions. I also point out to them, for example, in when I'm teaching young fellows to do magic routines and think as a magician, I say, never walk on stage and say, I have here a regular deck of cards. No, because that allows them the possibility of thinking, maybe that's not a regular deck of cards. But if you take a deck of cards, unwrap it, break the seal on it, shake it out into your hand, toss the box away, start shuffling it, the assumption is it's an ordinary deck of cards. Right. Now, they're not convinced of it necessarily, but at least they make that tentative assumption.
Mm-hmm. Right, but if you make a specific claim, then you're inviting them to question that claim.
Exactly, and you don't invite them to question any of these things.
Our brains make a lot of subconscious assumptions for us.
Indeed.
And once you learn what those are, then you really can freak people out. That's what the basis of a lot of optical illusions is, exploiting those assumptions that our brain is making just by the way it evolved to process information. For example, if something's smaller, it probably is farther away. Things get smaller as it gets farther away. So you could trick people with optical illusions to think that something is farther away by presenting them with a smaller version of something than they're used to seeing, for example. How do magicians take advantage of that kind of thing?
In an illusion box. Now, we all know that there are boxes that are designed specially to create optical effects and illusions. Suppose you have a large square box there into which a girl would fit, sort of curled up, if she wanted to curl up and if she were there. And when you open the front of the box, you see nothing. Now, the girl, this is hypothetical, of course, may be behind the box, hanging out the back a bit, for example. And believe me, that could happen. If you design the inside of the box, now I've seen magicians make big mistakes where the inside of the box is black, for example. Mm. When you look at black like that, you see nothing. Right. You're not seeing empty, you're seeing nothing. If it's bright red or yellow or something, or blue or whatever, you can sort of see the back of it, but it's still a massive color.
Can you give me another example of a way in which a magician on stage would exploit those kind of neurological assumptions people make in order to carry out an illusion?
Addressing the audience, for example, the magician may put his hand in his pocket casually and chat with them and make a few jokes, perhaps. He may do that for a very good reason, not because he's trying to get rid of something or get something from his pocket. He wants them to get used to the fact that he often addressed them by putting his hand casually into his pocket and then nodding at them and walking about the stage casually. Now, next time he puts his hand in his pocket, it may be to get or to get rid of something. So they've begun to accept that that's the way this man behaves. Mm-hmm. He does this sort of thing. So that's a good, neurological situation for you, if you wish.
Yeah, so you habituate them
to the
elements of the trick, which are critical to the trick itself, but you don't want it to stand out.
Give you a really good working example of that. Many years ago, when I was just a tad, little guy, and I went to the casino theater, I'll never forget it, I saw a Chinese magician who, he had a wonderful effect. He had a limp, first of all. He was a little gimpy. But he handled it very well, and you saw that he had this problem with his gait. And he would go around the stage, big smile, wonderful production of goldfish and every sort of wonderful animal and object. He closed his show with a big extravaganza with all the girls on stage, some very statuesque young ladies, I'm going to say. With this gimp on it, you got sort of used to seeing him almost stumble about, not quite, but just a slight hesitation in his gait. And then they dressed in big headdresses and costumes, very flowery, and his chief assistant came forward, a statuesque blonde, and she put on this lion head of some kind and with a big cape and bright gold-colored costume, and he was in a dark green costume with spangles all over it, and he put on some other sort of dragon head. The two of them danced about on the stage and mixed in with the rest of the crew. And then they went down to the back of the stage, way downstage, and then came forward. They marched forward holding hands, and suddenly he lost his gimp. And she picked it up. And when they reached the front of the stage, they took off the heads. That was the magician. That was the girl. And they had changed costumes on the way somehow, changed position. But the gimp, when we saw him leave the theater afterwards, he wasn't limping. That was entirely an act that he sold the audience on accepting that he as the one who stumbled about the stage.
And of course, the reason why we are interested in this kind of thing, both as skeptics and as magicians, the lesson here is that anyone could be fooled, because we all have the same meat in our heads, the same hardwiring, the same processing.
And is that a technical term? Meat in your head? Yes, okay.
Yes, we're all meatheads. And therefore, anyone could be fooled. We are not perfect processors of information.
No.
There's lots of ways in which the way we perceive things and think about things is flawed. And that can lead us to erroneous conclusions. Now, magicians use that for entertainment, by leading us to erroneous conclusions and then revealing something which then entertains us. But, of course, psychics and frauds and charlatans can use the same tricks in order to exploit the innocent or exploit
Very
people.
True.
And no one is beyond being fooled, because we all have the same human neurology.
Exactly. And we have the same weaknesses and the same strength. You know, I'm astonished. You have been astonished about this all of your life, but I'm astonished every time I discover something new that this hunk of gray jelly behind my ears will do or won't do, because there are a lot of things that it won't do. I'm rather satisfied. At the age of 80, I guess I've learned a few things somewhere along the line. Steve, I want to thank you for coming in today. It's a great pleasure to see you and your companions that came along with you. It was fun, and we'll have to do this again sometime.
Thank you, Randy. Always a pleasure.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to sniff out the fake. I believe it was just 1 week ago that I got all of you guys, wasn't it?
I don't remember that, actually. I think
I have no recollection of that either.
It was a clean sweep.
No. My therapist says not to remember such dark episodes in my history.
Well, let's see how you guys do this week. Are you ready?
Hurry up.
Yes.
All right. Number one. Scientists have discovered the first known ant species that form their colonies and live their lives entirely within the body of large mammals.
Good.
Whoa.
Number two, scientists discover that so-called silent mutations, those that do not affect the amino acid sequence a gene codes for, are not necessarily silent and can have dramatic effects. And item number three, researchers have found a new type of nerve fiber in the skin that fire only when the skin is stroked at a certain speed.
Ooh.
Uh-huh. Sexy.
Yeah, that one is sexy. Jay, go first.
Okay, so first one, scientists have discovered the first known ant species that form their colonies and live their lives entirely within the body of large mammals. Holy Jesus, that is gross. Man. All right, so large mammals.
Scientifically
elephants,
speaking.
Elephants. I mean, it's, like, we could rule out whales probably, because, but if they're inside.
With little scuba gear on?
Yeah.
Little ants with scuba gear?
I don't know.
Work.
I mean,
bunch of Jonas.
Could you imagine? Imagine if you're an animal like an elephant who's actually very intelligent, but doesn't have fingers and can't really scratch its own back, and there's like a colony of ants living in your upper ass.
Well, you do have a quite long and quite flexible trunk.
Or you have a buddy nearby and say, hey, get the damn ants off.
Yeah. Okay. Number two, scientists discover that so-called silent mutations, those that do not affect the amino acid sequence gene codes for, are not necessarily silent and can have dramatic effects like singing. Okay, sure. Next one, researchers have found a new type of nerve fiber in the skin that fire only when the skin is stroked at a certain speed. That one, I don't know, that seems to make sense. Wouldn't you agree, Rebecca?
No help from
I'd
the
rather
others.
Not comment, thank you. Until my turn.
I'm thinking that the third one is probably true. That's the speed of stroking skin. I'm thinking that the first one is like insanely horrific and seems unlikely. And that second one doesn't seem that big of a deal, is it? A full colony of ants living in your ass. That's disgusting, Steve.
I don't think the word ass was ever brought up until you started speaking, Jay.
But where else are they going to crawl into and live? Oh, man. That can't be true. That's the fake.
All right. Bob?
The nerve fiber, I mean, at first blush, it seems like, how were they going to find a nerve fiber that hasn't been discovered until now? But you're so sensitive to touch in some ways, like getting a massage and things. It seems like such an awesome experience. I could see a nerve fiber dedicated just for that. The silent mutations, but that doesn't surprise me with all the subtle effects we're seeing in genetics. So I'm not totally surprised by that. The first one, though, I've got a problem with, because now maybe it's just the way you worded this, Steve, but if they live their entire lives within the body of large animals, how do they get in there? They've got to have part of the life cycle where they're not inside the body,
Bob,
but in order to get in there. Yeah,
Bob, they crawl in through the ass.
Oh, my God.
So I think that might be the fatal flaw in that statement, Steve.
Well, I think the implication there is that once the colony is established.
Okay. Does that mean that you have to have a colony finding their way inside an animal, and then they get together and like, okay, this is it.
I just got
this is home.
Where Jay's confusing ass here. He's colon, colonies. ass. That's where that is.
Yeah, that's just so bizarre that... That may be why you want us to pick it, but I'm going to pick it anyway and say that's fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
Yeah, that's certainly fishy. I mean, ants. That's really creepy and weird, and I can't imagine it being true. The others are certainly understandable enough. I think that, I'm going to go with the ant thing. I think that's BS.
Okay, Evan?
Oh... See, that's the bad part about going last.
Everyone else goes go before you.
Oh, there's that. And that, you know, you've come to you've made your decision and
stick
then
you're to
just
your guns,
your turn
Evan.
In line. Yeah, well, it's the ants is the fiction. You know, number two, the silent mutations and having dramatic effects, also known as silent but deadly. Totally totally plausible.
Mm-hmm.
And then the nerve fiber. I thought maybe that was the curveball this week. Steve, I know how you like your neurology.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the ants. That one is fiction.
Okay. So you all agree
that
scientists discover that so-called silent mutations, those that do not affect the amino acid sequence a gene codes for, are not necessarily silent and can have dramatic effects. And yes, Jay, I would have found that to be surprising.
Yeah.
That definitely goes against a lot of conventional genetics. But that one is science.
Okay.
Woo-hoo,
this is a very
yay.
Surprising discovery. So these are so-called synonymous or silent mutations.
Please explain.
So the DNA is comprised of genes. You know, genes have a sequence of amino acids. And every three base pairs in the gene codes for a specific amino acid. There are 20 amino acids, which are the basic building blocks of proteins. Right, so as you're reading along the DNA, every three base pairs is the next amino acid, and that tells what sequence to attach the amino acids to build the protein. Now, there are 64 different possible three-letter combinations in the DNA code, but there's only 20 amino acids. That means that there is redundancy, that there are for each amino acid, there's more than one three-letter combination that will code for it, right? So a silent mutation is one in which you change one letter, one base pair, from one nucleic acid to another, but it still codes for the same amino acid. So it doesn't result in a change in the amino acid sequence, right? Therefore, silent or synonymous. What they found is, they did a very interesting study. They looked at a gene that codes for a green glowing protein. And they compared the different synonymous mutations of this protein. And what they found was that in some variants, a much greater amount of the protein was produced.
Whoa.
While in other synonymous mutations, there was much less. So even though the protein was exactly the same, these silent mutations were regulating how much it was getting expressed, how much the gene was getting expressed, or how much of it was being... how much protein was being made from it.
So that impacts proteomics then.
Absolutely. And this is also it's a yet another type of genetic disease that somebody could have. So you might have a gene that produces a perfectly normal protein, but maybe it's making too much of it or not enough of it because of these silent mutations that previously we weren't paying that much attention to. Not for medical purposes anyway. I mean...
Wow. When did that come out, Steve?
Definitely would have surprised me. That was published on April 9th, so last week.
Would you have picked that one, Steve?
I don't know. It's hard. I mean, that definitely would have surprised me. I was surprised when I read it. I'm like, oh. Then also, my second thought was, oh, crap, the intelligent design buffoons are going to jump all over this one.
Yeah.
You know, not that it in any way calls into question any of the lines of evidence for evolution, but, you know, that's what they do, is they, every time we discover something new, they say, oh, that really throws a wrench in it, you know, and then they try to somehow distort it to make it sound like it calls into question the bigger picture of evolution itself.
The fact of evolution.
Right.
Instead of the theory.
Let's go on to the third one. You guys also all agreed that researchers have found a new type of nerve fiber in the skin that fire only when the skin is stroked at a certain speed. And that one is science.
Yeah.
Yay.
So you guys made a clean sweep this week to make up for last week.
Got you again, Novella.
Good job.
That was an interesting one.
Yeah, this is interesting. And what they did find was that there are a specific type of nerve fibers in the skin called C-tactile nerves, or CT nerves. And these nerves fire. What they showed was that they fire when they are stimulated, but only at a certain frequency.
What frequency?
Well, they actually don't say.
Kenneth.
But...
What?
So, and they're clearly designed to respond to touch, but not static touch, but, you know, but a stroking at a certain speed. So what they did was, you know, they actually had like a robot or something, a mechanical device, so the speed was precise. Provide tactile stimulation to the subject's arm, for example, and it's only on certain parts of the body. So the hands do not have these nerve endings, but the skin that would normally have hair follicles would have it. So like your arm, for example. As they increased the speed, the nerves fired more and more and more to some peak, and then but too fast, and they would stop firing again. So there was this range of speeds of like stroking the skin where these would fire. Now, the other aspect of this is that the sensation produced by the activation of these nerves was very pleasurable, that it produced a specifically pleasant sensation.
And it could mute pain, too. Wasn't that another aspect
yes.
of it?
Yes, and although this has been known for a long time, but this is consistent with the notion of counter-irritation. You know, if you bang your elbow when it hurts, you rub it.
Yeah, rub it.
You know, why do you rub it? You rub it because you're activating other pathways. Well, this is one other pathway that gets activated that does not carry pain signals, but it does inhibit the pain pathways.
What if a bunch of ants were inside of me?
Yeah. So that's fake.
You know, vibrating.
So glad that's fake.
Scientists have discovered the first known ant species that form their colonies and live their lives entirely within the body of large mammals is complete another and utter fiction. However, you guys are not following your previous pattern, so your past is not was not a good prediction of the future. Because in the past,
yes,
you have endorsed the notion that you would believe any creepy thing about insects, first of all, and that the most outlandish item is usually the one that you think I threw in there to deceive you, and therefore you end up going with it.
But see, I've said things that are similar to that, Steve, but it's not the exact truth. It's something, sometimes there, you know, you give us the three options and there's something very suspicious about one that sticks out that is so completely outlandish that it must be true. So it's not necessarily that always the most outlandish one has got to be
true. I know.
Just, you're right.
In some circumstances.
And I try to mix it up. I try to make sometimes the most outlandish one be the fake, sometimes not the fake.
All right, but where'd you get this from?
And this time
you
failed. You
didn't make that up wholesale, did you?
Not wholesale. It's based on something. But what they did find was the first species of ant that reproduces completely asexually via cloning.
I saw that. Ladies doing it for themselves.
Yeah,
wait, so how did you get... How'd you get the freaking ant crawling in the ass scenario from that?
That's the part that I made up, Jay.
You, Jay, made up the ass part.
Rebecca, we've clearly established that there's no other way in.
No, it could have gotten in through the eye, the nose, the mouth. right?
The ass,
no, just
ear.
Just the ass. There,
parasites find their way into animals through all kinds of orifices.
Cuts.
Sure. You know. Food.
Under the fingernails.
Enemas.
God.
My favorite parasite is that worm that crawls across your eyeball. And then
stop.
Just, nice. That's awesome.
What's your favorite parasite?
The other one I like is the one that when you're sleeping, it crawls out of your nose and down into your mouth.
Shut up. That doesn't...
Why not just crawl from the inside and go around? Why?
Whatever. That's its life cycle. Parasites are creepy. Anyway, so this is all female ants. The queens have completely asexual reproduction. Now, asexual reproduction is not unknown in insects or in ants, but this is the first one that does it exclusively, and that's the new bit.
That is cool. And not nearly as gross as you made it out.
That's right. Not as gross as living inside a person.
You have quite an imagination, Steve.
Yeah, you know. Sometimes I got to push the envelope. Evan, it's that time. It's that time.
Who's that noisy?
Hey, Evan. Evan.
Yo.
What's this?
Yes, sir.
What's this?
Who's that noisy, Jay?
I know. Who's that noisy?
Who's that noisy?
Now you got to tell us now.
I'll tell you next week.
Oh, you going to do your own sort of sideline? Who's that noisy?
Am I stealing Evan's great. Thunder? That's... I'm sorry, Evan.
No, that's okay. I got a quote lined up, so I'm all set.
Evan. Well, Evan, play last week's Who's That Noisy for us.
All right, folks. Here it is. That noise was the recording of the erosion of Europe's largest glacier.
Wow.
In Iceland.
Now that's kind
of
sad.
So they stuck a microphone way, way down into the crevasse or cracks of a glacier and
Phil McCracken
recorded what it sounded like. That is the sound of
water.
Glaciers breaking apart.
That was ice melting. Yes, that was ice melting, guys.
Within a glacier. Glacier eroding, technically.
Yeah, ice melting. Right.
Yes.
Okay.
That was a hard one.
It was a hard one. And you would think nobody would have a shot.
Did anyone get it?
That. Well, yeah, someone, well, here I'll explain what happened.
Okay.
There were a lot of guesses. Nobody got it on their first guess. However, someone threw out four guesses, and his fourth guess was correct. But it happened to be the only person to respond correctly. So I guess it has to go to this guy.
All right.
And who's that?
That would be Philip Poyter from the message boards.
Congratulations, Philip.
And, you know, there's also been some discussion as to how people should go about posting their answers or, you know, getting us the answers.
Yeah.
For the Who's That Noisy segment.
I think officially we don't care.
No. Don't care at all.
Yeah, we can't formalize this.
But, yeah. Evan, give us this week's Who's That Noisy.
All right. Here is this week's Who's That Noisy.
We had no idea about how this stuff could be done. We're sort of like, where were people with gravity before Newton came along? I mean, gravity worked, clearly, but no one had an idea how. So similarly, here's some things that we saw worked and happened, but no idea how.
All right.
I don't have a good feeling about that one, Evan.
That was obviously a man.
Yeah.
You can say that much.
If you can
speaking English.
Identify the man.
I'm going to guess that guy is not talking about other well-formed sciences. He's talking, you know, that's my guess right now.
Yeah, just a hunch. And please keep sending in your recordings, whatever you want to do with it, get creative, of introing the Who's That Noisy bit, although we do like cute little kids saying Who's That Noisy in foreign accents. But we're certainly not restricted to that. But you know.
Rebecca, who's David Hume?
He's a philosopher.
Okay, he said, when men are most sure and arrogant, they are commonly most mistaken. Giving views to passion without that proper deliberation, which alone can secure them from the grossest absurdities. David Hume!
Thank you, Jay. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Surely.
Thank you, Steve.
It was a pleasure to be joined to you.
Good job on science fiction, everyone.
You can let
thank
go.
You
really kicked your ass.
Wait till next.
Yeah, wait till next week. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.